Hi, my name's Nikki Anderson and I'm director of the Feminist Writers Festival. Welcome to this podcast of our FWF 2020 session, Our Culture of Violence, made possible by Creative Victoria. Here, disability rights advocate Nicole Lee, Indigenous family violence expert Dr. Kylie Cripps, and gender equality campaigner Christina Zavica discuss the language around violence and victims, the challenges within resourcing family violence initiatives, and violence and marginality. We acknowledge that this recording took place across Australia on First Nations lands, lands whose sovereignty has never been ceded.
Hi, everyone. My name's Jess. I am from the Feminist Writers Festival. I'm on the board of the Feminist Writers Festival, and I'm going to be your MC this morning for this panel on our culture of violence. All right, let's turn to introducing our panelists. So let's start with Nicole Lee. Nicole Lee is a family violence survivor, passionate public advocate, and previous member of Victoria's first Victim Survivors Advisory Council. Lee, who uses a wheelchair, focuses on family violence perpetrated against those who have a disability or depend on carers. Our next wonderful panelist for today is Dr. Kylie Cripps, and she is a CNTR Fellow and Senior Lecturer in the Law Faculty at University of New South Wales. Kylie, as a Palawan woman, has worked extensively over the past 20 years in the areas of family violence, sexual assault, and child abuse with Indigenous communities. And our wonderful chair for today is Christina Zavica, and she is a Melbourne-based columnist and consultant who has had 20 years' experience working in Australia, the United States, and the UK on human rights and gender equality campaigns. So I am now going to fade politely into the background and hand over to Christina to chair this session. And a big thank you and welcome to all of you.
All right. Thank you, Jed. My name is Christina Zavica. I'm delighted to be here at the Feminist Writers Festival, and I welcome you all to what will be a hopefully very thought-provoking and challenging panel today. And I'd like to welcome our two wonderful panelists today. Thank you so much for joining us. So I hope that all of you have had a chance to read the essay contributions that they've that are up on the Feminist Writers Festival's website. And today we're going to be talking about the theme of cultures of violence. And just to get the discussion started, I'll give you two an opportunity to speak to that topic more broadly. But when I was reading both of your essays, I noticed that a theme that emerged very strongly in both of them was how violence that impacts particular groups of women, disabled women, Indigenous women, is framed. So I think we're going to talk a lot about framing today. And Nick, you talk a lot about wanting to challenge the language of vulnerability, which you describe as a kind of victim blaming. And I think that a lot of our audience members today will be quite familiar with that concept of victim blaming, more for a mainstream audience. And I'd love you to kind of unpack what you mean by that. And Kylie, you talk about that framing of Indigenous communities as somehow inherently violent. Can you both speak to, you know, what the issue of framing means to you and why you particularly chose to take that on as an issue when discussing cultures of violence? And I'll turn to you first, Kylie.
Thank you, Christine. I might start by acknowledging country as well. As is customary in my culture as an Aboriginal woman, I pay my respects to the traditional lands of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and also pay my respects to our elders, both past and present. And I also acknowledge the many people working tirelessly in our communities and with our communities at the present time to keeping them safe. I also want to acknowledge, as Jasmine did, that it is NAIDOC Week and that the theme for this year's celebrations is always was, always will be, recognising that First Nations peoples have been and have occupied and cared for this continent for over 65,000 years. Thus, it's an important week for reflection of where we've been and for considering where we want to be moving forward. And today's event then is an important event for imagining safer futures together. So when I was thinking about writing this piece, I was thinking about it in the context of how over the last 30 years, how has Indigenous domestic and family violence and sexual assault and child abuse been framed? How has the media engaged with these particular issues? How has services engaged with it? How has government engaged with it? And often it is to say that violence is extremely bad in Indigenous communities. And we don't shy away from that. The violence is bad in our communities. But the framing of it is such that, you know, when you've got headlines, as I write about it in these article for today, when you've got headlines that says sex abuse rife in the NT, or, you know, a culture of violence that must change, it puts the blame squarely on Indigenous people. And it neglects some of the nuances that exist around the issue of violence in our community. So the nuances of that it's not always Aboriginal men that are perpetrating the violence. And there are some really good examples of where it hasn't been Aboriginal men that have committed the violence, and then we turn the lens back on the victim of violence. So what was it about her that allowed her to be the victim of violence? So a well-known case is the Lynette Daly case on the New South Wales north coast. You know, that was an horrific sexual homicide, and the media around that case was that it was a sex death. It wasn't a case of, you know, that she was the victim of a sexual homicide. And, you know, the media characterised it as that she, you know, she was drinking alcohol. So that had to be part of the problem, that she was somehow an inept mother, that she was, you know, put all the blame on her. And then it focused on the men's portrayal of her through the testimony that had been given in court. And the catchphrase that I remember from that material was, boys will be boys and girls will be girls. There's nothing about this that was boys will be boys and girls will be girls. This was a sexual homicide. This was violent. And none of this was acceptable. And I think that we have to be mindful of that when we look at this through the lens of what's acceptable in our communities. We have to be challenging this culture of violence that says, you know, that the violence is acceptable in particular communities, or that it's acceptable by particular genders because of their race. And, you know, there are numerous examples through that article that talks to that. And whatever we don't confront those issues, then we put people's lives at risk. Doesn't that answer the question, Christine?
Yeah, it does. And I think that segues very nicely to some of the very similar themes that Nicole wrote about beautifully in her essay, particularly the issue of victim blaming and in which kind of communities, and what that idea of the perfect victim, which we've spoken about before, like who is the perfect victim, in which kinds of communities is this kind of violence deemed acceptable? So do you want to talk a little bit about that as well, Nick, why you chose to tackle the issue of framing, and particularly the idea of vulnerability?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just acknowledge the traditional owners of the land in which I'm meeting as well. So I'm also Wurundjeri. I think I'm on Wurundjeri Willem people out here, because I'm outer Melbourne, on the outer skirts. And pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. And I'd also like to pay respects to, you know, Indigenous women with disabilities that do great work in our community, from artists to advocates to activists as well, especially during NAIDOC week. So choosing vulnerability for me is something that it's been the product of a lot of conversations with other disabled women around me from different organisations. And this year has been a bit of a horrific year for us in the community. Earlier on in the year, with the the death of not just Willow Dunn, but Anne Marie Smith, and the shock and horror that kind of sent through us as a community and through the broader community. But then the reframing and the language that was used to sit around, you know, it's such a horrific case. It's not classed as a manslaughter in the beginning. It's classed as she was neglected, but she was neglected to death. She was deliberately targeted and for the purpose of abusing and exploiting and stealing from. And you know, her whole agency and autonomy as an individual and as a woman and a contributor to her community was completely and utterly taken away. Yet we continually were positioning, you know, the media was continually positioning her in that language of being, you know, one of the most vulnerable people in our community. And then we started having reports coming out, you know, the Quality and Safeguarding Commission, and she wasn't identified as being, you know, a vulnerable participant of the NDIS or a vulnerable adult. And when we start framing disabled people and disabled women as vulnerable, we're saying that we don't have any agency and that our rights to make choices and our rights to autonomy is controlled by the world around us. It dismisses the, you know, the violent situations and the controlling situations that we're placed in via these systems, and it completely avoids the accountability and responsibility for the ones who abused us. You know, there's very little spoken of all of the different, you know, services and systems, and whilst there's been one person charged with manslaughter, this was many, many people, but we continually position Anne-Marie as being this vulnerable woman, and we've completely dismissed all of the people that were responsible around her. And that happens to us time and time again. Now, they're just the ones that make it into the media. Mm. And we see if we continue, and what I tried to touch on in that article was that, you know, that women with disabilities, you know, we do experience, you know, quite alarming rates of violence against us. There's barriers to reporting. You know, we are seen as targets by people who are choosing to abuse or choosing to abuse their position of power, who are vulnerable to abusing their position of power. And whilst we're constantly phrased as being vulnerable, those people are going to continually see us as targets. You know, it's just so dismissive. And I think one of the beautiful quotes that I put in there from some academia that I came across is that it just states the people that, you know, that disabled women are vulnerable, not and avoids looking at all the reasons why. And, you know, it's something that's not written about as much as I would like. It was very hard to find any sort of writing in an academic space to position along with this article. You know, there's some really good stuff out there, but there's just not a whole kind of suite and cohort of things. And we're only just really starting to jump into doing research around violence perpetrated against people with disabilities, and in particular, mm-hmm. you know, gender-based violence against people with disabilities. So for me, having this opportunity to write that essay and position us as being, you know, we do have autonomy, we have mm-hmm. a right to have agency, and how this language then enables the system, enables everybody else around us to be custodians of our agency versus us being empowered and enabled to be in custodians of our own agency and supported to find that if we haven't already. For a lot of us, you know, we've been denied a lot of these things in our life, and how that system continues to deny all those things around us.
Thanks, Nick. I think we'll return to that theme of agency and giving voice and empowerment in just a minute. But I just wanted to pick up on a bit of a theme that's emerging, that did emerge quite strongly in both of your essays and is emerging in the things that you're talking about today. I was struck by a quote from Kylie's essay that how we frame this culture of violence really influences how we define the problems and the solutions. And that in itself is really at the core of why this issue is so important and those types of framings can and are so problematic. And when we get into the solutions and the empowering and giving voice part of the conversation in a minute, but can you both just sort of dig down a little bit deeper and give some examples or talk a little bit about how those types of framings really do inhibit us from, I think you've started to speak to that, inhibit us from seeing the nature of the problem and seeing the solutions that are necessary.
Yeah, I think often what we characterize as the solution to violence is that we need a criminal response, and that the criminal response is going to be the answer because it's going to provide the perpetrator with accountability. But what we don't appreciate when we have that as the response is how accessible that is or isn't for our populations. So we don't think about, for example, the history of police relations in this country for Indigenous peoples, that it may not be a safe option for Indigenous women, for example, to call the police. And particularly on the back of, every other week there being a social media post of our children or our men or other women even being treated appallingly by police. And so, I think that we have to be conscious that we are savvy in the 2020 in being connected in a social media context, that we are across what is happening in our worlds. And so that's going to impact the choices that we make about whether we involve police or not in seeking safety. The other important point in thinking through solutions is if police attend, they are also mandatory reporters to child protection. So for many of our women, they're very conscious that if the police are called, the likelihood is, if not that day, in the days that follow, child protection are going to come knocking on the door. And that carries the very real risk that our families are going to get fractured in some way or shape or form, or that they're going to be particularly judged to a standard of, are you operating as a nuclear family would? And many families, we're a community that works with an extended family network. So I know of some families who, don't necessarily have food in their cupboard because they go to Nana's for dinner, for lunch, and so Nana's the ones that have got all the food in the cupboard. And so when child protection come knocking on the door and they check your cupboard and you've got no food in the cupboard, that's a negative mark against you. And so, I think that we need to be conscious of when we engage in the services, what are the services coming to us to judge us through? What's their lens that they're looking at? Are they coming with a cultural lens that's understanding our worlds and the experiences through which we're understanding and appreciating violence? Are they also understanding that other services are going to have demands on us, and so that we're having to negotiate multiple demands, not just the demands of their particular service? And so in that context, you trade one power and control relationship with a perpetrator with a power and control relationship with the state, right? And so at what point do we give self-empowerment and self-determination back to victims? When do we give them credit for surviving in the circumstances that they've been in? When do we say to them, you've been a wonderful mum? You protected your children in the most horrible of circumstances. We don't give these mums sufficient credit for all of the circumstances they've been in. So I think there's a lot that we need to do in terms of reflecting back on our systems in terms of are they really helping, or are they perpetuating that culture of violence in ways that further disempower our women.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kylie. And I'll just hand over to you now, Nick, because I know that you've had quite a lot to say about this, particularly in the last few weeks. I'll just draw attention to another essay that you wrote about the coercive control debate, which was published in Women's Agenda. So I don't know if you want to speak to those issues that Kylie's raised on their own, or if you'd like to speak to that in the context of that ongoing debate as well.
Probably in a bit of both, and in the context of that ongoing debate and just the way, and very, very similar to Kylie, disabled women, and disabled people, the way the criminal justice system treats us and views us is quite negative. When systems do get called, like, believe me, as a woman with a disability who was experiencing violence, the last thing I wanted to do was run to the system. So for most of us also, I didn't just have a disability, I've got complex mental health conditions as well, which is pretty understandable when you've lived with such high levels of violence for such a long period of time, most of us do come out of it, you know, a little bit dented by the end. And so, you know, that fear of child protection, police had been used as a weapon against me to be arrested, taken to hospital, put on, you know, involuntary treatment orders. And this is what happens to us. You know, all of these things that other people run to for protection, we're running away from because they've been used to control us, to abuse us, and to be part of that sort of bringing people down and disempowering people. And then when you get into a courtroom, you know, I've been in that room where I've gotten that quote-unquote justice that everybody talks about, but the way disability is framed within a courtroom against a guilty man was that I was constantly phrased as being somebody with lots of difficulties, complex mental health, burden, that he had resentment for me for all of the stuff that he had to do as a carer. Like, these things have a huge impact on us. These systems are not safe for us. And especially at the moment, if we're looking at bringing in coercive control laws, we have to really look at that issue as being an intersectional issue. You know, how does that language of vulnerability and burden sit with multiple different diverse communities, and looking at that intersectional layered effect, and we look at the, you know, the rates of you know, disability within the Indigenous community as well, then they've got that double layered effect of not only you know, inherent racism within the system, but also ableism as well on top of that, and how much harder this is and how much more at risk they are of being victimised by that system as well, or even possibly criminalised by that system that is actually meant to be there to protect them. So whilst all of these conversations are really great and they're really valuable, we do have to constantly remember at the forefront of our mind that these systems were built by white men who came to this country for the purpose of colonising, to, you know, a place to put the people they didn't want and dismantle and destroy the people that they didn't need. And these are the systems that we are fighting against. And these are the systems that we have to remember who is going to be impacted, who are the unintended consequences whenever we look at bringing in anything new, and making sure that we're not throwing some women under the bus inadvertently. Not saying that anybody would ever do that intentionally, but, you know, these are the things that in all of these conversations we have to come together and do those things together. Otherwise, these conversations, we go into them divided, we are going to end up fighting against each other and doing the work of the patriarchy. And I guess sort of, you know, the only other sort of thing to kind of, you know, add to, I guess, you know, what Kylie was saying before, you know, sort of, you know, you've got all these systems as well, but, you know, you've got these systems that then come in and they are looking for examples of you failing. So I had Child Protection constantly monitoring me every single month, looking at my children, checking out my house, and, you know, they're looking for signs of failure rather than looking for signs that we're thriving and actually congratulating, you know, talking to you and saying, you know, that's really great work, you know, you're doing a really great job. I didn't hear a lot of those words. And you're all of this monitoring, even if there's no violence for, you know, disabled mothers. You know, from the moment I had my children, I had nurses looking for signs of failure versus signs of thriving. And these are the things we're constantly fighting. So these are the reasons why we just do not trust systems. We do not trust those systems that other people feel really, really confident with. You know, we just don't, because we've had lifetimes of all of this stuff. We've had lifetimes of being viewed as not good enough, or being viewed as, you know, waiting to fail, so to speak. Yeah. And then, like, so my last point with that is, and then that language around, you know, violence then gets normalised. And I think I heard that a lot with myself, and I've heard that a lot with other people. And the thing is, if you're constantly speaking up and no one's believing you, the violence isn't normalised. It's just nobody's going to listen and nobody's going to believe you. I'd like to put that back on anyone that says, you know, violence is normalized in certain communities. Well, entitlement gets normalized in certain people. and does that make them feel comfortable? So it's not normalized. It's just people stop listening, so we stop telling. And, you know, if you're not going to listen and you're not going to ask us the questions, we're not going to tell you. That doesn't mean we're not happy or we don't know what violence is. And the other toxic one is around, you know, intellectual disability. You know, you don't have to be, you know, have a high intellect to know that you're unhappy, to know that what you're experiencing is violence, and to be able to feel pain as well. And I think this is all of those dismissing things that accumulate and pile in on communities that we have to really start looking at and wondering why are these systems not safe for us or for, you know, other communities as well.
Thanks, Nick. And one of the things that you touched upon just now was the kind of culture of violence being based on good intentions. And Kylie talks a lot about that in her essay as well. And that in itself is disempowering. And so to transition to, and I loved that Kylie had a sort of whole section in her essay, which was, what are the solutions? And can we talk a little bit about how that culture of violence includes this kind of concept of good intentions? Well, they had the best of intentions, and how that in and of itself is disempowering and produces those kinds of unintended consequences that you've been touching upon today. And how do we tackle that culture so women can be self-determining and empowered?
I think that's a good question and a big question.
It's a big question. And I'm minded that we could probably talk about that alone for probably a few hours. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, to start with, we've got to get a bigger table, right, Kylie?
Yeah, we do. We do. And a bigger table that recognises that it shouldn't be just a table that's full of service providers or government policymakers. It's got to be a table that has as key stakeholders Indigenous women or the people that are experiencing this violence. I think that if you don't have them at the table, then you don't appreciate the circumstances that they're encountering every single day. You don't appreciate the unintended consequences of your good intentions. And so I think having them at the table is that check and balance. It's that check and balance of, okay, we're proposing to do this. What's your thoughts on this? Is this going to work? And it's being a table too. I've been at many tables where you have government workers and Indigenous community members, and the Indigenous community members don't feel that the table's equal, that they have the power to speak. And I think that we have to work out how we're going to enable that table to operate in a way that's equitable, where people do feel empowered to speak and where that power and control doesn't exist. Because when you enable these people to speak, I can't tell you how many times I've been out in the community and you sit and you listen to our elders, you sit and listen to the women, you sit and listen to the kids. They know what's going to work in these communities, right? They know and they tell you their stories. I can remember only a few, about 2 years ago, sitting out in a community, and one of the women said to me, "All I need is a house. I have been on the public housing wait list for 2 years. They've told me today that I will never get my kids back. They told me to move to another state. Or to move interstate or to another city and just restart my life again, and because I'm not going to get my kids back." That's because we've changed the laws, and the laws say that, you've only got 2 years now to be able to get your kids back. The reason why she's homeless is because the state doesn't have enough housing supply. So why don't we have a table that has the housing minister sitting at the table hearing these women's stories, saying, right, we need to fix the housing supply so that we recognise that that's part of the problem. And not say, well, we're going to give you some rental assistance. Well, for Aboriginal women, many Aboriginal women, I think people forget there's racial discrimination in this country. They can't just go and rent a private rental in this country. They do rely on public housing. So we have to be thinking about if they're not at the table, they can't tell you these things, right? And that's my biggest point is let's hear from them what they think are the solutions. And the other point that I'd say is we've got more than two decades worth of government reports into Indigenous violence that tell us the solutions, and we've ignored them. it's not okay for that to have taken place when these, you know, our communities have poured their hearts out into what those solutions should be, and governments have decided that for some reason they're not credible. And the other point that I'll say, two final point, then I'll pass it to you, Nick. I talk too much, I know.
All good.
It is, you know, one of the elders in Little Children Are Sacred said, we've been piloting pilots for long enough, right? And we have 6-month programs, 1-year programs, 2-year programs don't work in violence against women, particularly when you think about it in this context. If you've got an 8-year-old child that's sexually assaulted tonight, what is she going to need tonight? She's going to need support services. She's going to need health services. And, yes, she's going to need police for protection and for the criminal matters that proceed. What's she going to need in a year's time? She's going to need all of those services continuing, probably. What is she going to need when she hits puberty? Some of those services still. What is she going to need when she gets her first sexual partner? What is she going to need when she gets pregnant for the first time, when we know quite clearly that that triggers a lot of memories for our young women? What is she going to need when, God forbid, her child gets sexually assaulted, when we know that in some of our Indigenous communities, 2 in 3 girls get sexually assaulted before their age of 18? Why is it that in this field we feel the pilots is good enough when we can see that this affects us over a life course? That's the point that we need to be looking at.
Yeah, absolutely agree with all of that. So I won't re-echo too much of what you've said. Yes, we do need people with lived experience in the conversations, in the positions of power, making decisions at the table. You know, we need disabled people, you know, in charge of the NDIS, you know, overseeing that policy for a beginning. You know, too many able people are running our NDIS, for one. For me, when it comes to violence, the NDIS and the family violence sector and, you know, the disability sector and the family violence sector actually connecting, working together, collaborating to finding ways that the NDIS can have that impact on, you know, creating environments where people are safe and valued and have, you know, their choice and control and their rights upheld. We rely far too heavily on informal supports in this country because it saves the government money. Unfortunately, not all carers are violent, but some are, and we need to have every option on the table available for people. Sorry, I've just got a bit off track there. But it's those two sectors actually recognising each other and actually recognising that they have a responsibility to and for each other. And one of the really, really brilliant initiatives that we've got here in Victoria, you know, for somebody experiencing violence and needing to escape, is that we have a brokerage funding system down here in Victoria called, you know, the Disability Family Violence Initiative Package, and it's, you know, it's, it used to be handled through DHHS. It's now handled through Safe Steps. And that needs to be rolled out nationwide. So we can make every refuge as accessible as we want. You know, it could have a ramp, and this is the thing, it's more than just a ramp. If you don't have access to carers who are not the ones abusing you, then how do you get to that refuge? How do you stay in that refuge? How do you continue to be seen as a competent mother if you don't have paid support workers helping you in your role of being a mother? Because you've been made reliant on informal supports and carers. That funding for me was the thing that made the difference. That funding saved my life. That funding got me out of violence. If it wasn't for that funding, I was on the verge of having him return to the home because I had no other options. You know, that brokerage funding is what shows us there is another way to live. So for women experiencing violence, I was completely broken down. I didn't know what my rights were. I didn't know what I was entitled to. And all I knew was that I needed this person to live. That funding showed me that there was another way to live. And this is what we need to be doing for women all over this country. We need to be changing that, you know, that critical realist, you know, understanding of where is the location of our community's knowledge and how do we grow it, build it, and spread that far and wide so people know that they've got rights that they can speak up for. that we can show them, yes, you might need somebody to live, but, you know, we can get somebody in to do that. You don't have to rely on this person who's abusing you. You can survive and be a mother with the right supports and be safe, and that is your right. And for me, that was a turning point. That was an aha moment in that I realized I can do this and I am going to be okay and I don't need this man back in my life. And I was able to see the difference between need and want. I might have needed him to live, but I didn't want him in my life to be able to live. And once I was shown a different way to live, that made the difference for me. So I would love to see that nationwide in every state and, you know, promoted via the NDIS as something that is available for women who are experiencing violence within the disability community, or anybody experiencing violence within the disability community, men, women and children.
Thank you, Nick. And I am mindful of the fact that we're discussing a lot of what will be for many people on the panel and watching today, deeply personal topics. And if you want to reach out for support, please do consult with any of the helplines that we mentioned earlier, including Lifeline and 1-800-RESPECT. So I'll just invite you all to ask some questions. I see that we have some right now. Speaking of the needs of people with lived experience at the table, and I love that concept, Nick, of a bigger table. In your experience of activism, how far do you think we've gotten to expanding the size of that table? A little bit of a loaded question. But speaking of that experience, how important are systems and language? In Kylie and Nicole's work, you've both talked about a chance to work with the media. What has that been like for you both? And thinking about, you know, we've had this on, and I've been part of that debate, we've had this debate in the last couple of years about how the media frames violence against women. And I think we're making some headway towards challenging that. But are we making enough headway, and are we doing it in an intersectional enough way in terms of challenging some of those language? Like you talk, Nick, about how the concept of vulnerability has particular connotations of victim blaming for disabled women.
Yeah, well, of course we need a bigger table, because we've also got to understand, you know, the definition of womanhood and being a woman is actually very broad. And we need to, you know, expand our understanding and make sure that there's, you know, room for all women, you know, at the table, not just what we sort of look at in class as being, you know, heterosexual, cisgendered women. But, you know, I think you're definitely right. The media has come a really long way in other regards in you know, with violence against women and sort of starting to rephrase that victim blaming narrative. And I think Jane Gilmore's work, you know, Fixed It has been quite a powerful, you know, representation of that. But, you know, this year sort of for the disability community, seeing that language of vulnerability coming in with you know, Willow Dunn and with quite a few other cases in Anne-Marie, it felt like we shifted backwards a little bit, or, you know, that lens hadn't quite lent itself to disabled women. And that's just, you know, for the ones that actually make it to the media, there's so many horrific cases that just do not get reported on because, you know, what they're not seen as getting traction, or and how, you know, we need to, you know, actually start reporting on these things so that the community knows exactly what's going on, how prevalent and horrific the violence is. Did you want to jump in, Kristen? Yeah. Kylie, sorry.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. When I looked at the Lynette Daly case, for example, there were many, I mean, that case took place in 2011, I think. It didn't really hit the media until 2015, 2016, when the family went to Four Corners and asked for there to be an inquiry and for them to run a program reflecting on the coroner. The coroner had pushed that there be some criminal charges laid against the individuals involved in that matter. And so families can use the media to actually be supportive of their cases. And so my question in that is why was it that it took the media so long to take an interest in that particular case? What was it about an Aboriginal woman's sexual homicide that made it so insignificant in 2011? Because at the same time, we also had a significant sexual homicide in Melbourne that hit national headlines, that had people marching in the streets. Yet Lynette Daly's case had none of that, right? So our media picks and chooses which cases hit the headlines and for what reasons. And so we need to be pushing that there needs to be some more prioritisation of that. The other important point that I want to say about the media too is about encouraging our community members to have some confidence in being involved in the media. I've been involved in some media training with some Aboriginal women a few years ago, and it was the most joyous experience I've ever been in. And it was a group of women that had never they'd never done media training. They were scared of the media, and it was part of a research project I was doing where, you know, the community recognised it as a need, that they wanted to change the frame in which Indigenous family violence was being talked about. They wanted to also present to the media the good things that they were doing in their community to talk about family violence. And that training was about working out what kind of messages they wanted to put out there in the community. And I'll give you a bit of humour because I think that it's needed in these kind of environments. And one of the aunties, and she's passed now, but she was and is the most beautifulest woman. And we had up on the whiteboard, so who are the messages we need to give to people? So if we had to give a message to police, what would it be? And her message was they need to stand and deliver. And then she looked at everyone. She says, you know, law and order say that every time it comes on, they need to stand and deliver. You know, our police don't turn up when we call them. And, yeah, you know, I've taken that phrase from law and order, but it actually means something, and I would be saying that to the media, right, that they need to turn up. And then her message to the men was, they need to look in the mirror and they need to make a change from Michael Jackson. She had all the moves and it was beautiful. But it was more the point that she could bring the humour, but the humour meant something to her. It meant something about the kind of message that we could engage with people in the community about these issues in ways that could be reflective of what we need to do to make changes, so that the media isn't just saying how bad it is, it's giving a solution. It's saying the police need to do something. The police need to support us. The men need to reflect on their behaviours. They need to be accountable to us. And there were a whole range of other messages, but again, you know, the leadership in our communities, the inspiration in our communities, being able to enable those women to be able to speak to media is really worthwhile.
Having that media representation, we've got Naz Campanella now championing her as a news reporter, as a woman with a disability for ABC. I'd love to see, yes, exactly that, more representation amongst newsreaders, panel hosts. I'd love to see a disabled person, you know, chairing the drum, or maybe even something like Q&A. Us in that sort of position of reporting and how different that makes. And I've done a few interviews with Naz Campanella now, and she just gets it. When she interviews you and she asks you questions, I don't have to spend time explaining to her what my position is or why. She's just like, oh, yes, that makes sense. Yeah. Yes, I get it. Oh, wow, yep. And that is a big difference for us, you know, to be interviewed by someone where I'm not constantly explaining myself, and they know how to weave that story together to make it really powerful, speak to the community, and puts it in a way that people actually sit up and listen. That, for all diverse communities, is a really important point moving forward.
Thank you. I really loved what you said, Kylie, about that being a joyous experience.
Yeah,
because I've been involved with media training for victim survivors as well, and I've had the same experience, that it is really a joyous and empowering experience to be able to vocally contribute to the debate and to say your piece and to say what you want to say. And I just want to acknowledge that I know that Nick has done some really fantastic work with the Let Her Speak campaign this week here in Victoria, which is really focused around precisely, you know, not only not silencing, but empowering women and their families who have been affected by these issues to tell their story in their words, when they're ready, on their own terms. And I thank you for that work, Nick. It's pretty phenomenal. Wondering if you could talk some more about disability and parenting and how the NDIS relies on the deficit model of things you can't do, which can be a scary space to engage with and to outline, and the things, rather than things that you can do independently, and advocating for the support that you need for other from the NDIS to do other things, and so you can thrive and get the support that you need and deserve.
Yeah, well, whenever we go into our planning meetings and everything for the NDIS, so to warrant needing supports, you have to say all that, you have to really say that you can't do it. And when you go into that parenting space and you start thinking about all those, intersecting services like child protection and all of those other areas. And like I said before, trying to identify, signs of failure as a parent and as a mother with a young child, going into the NDIS space, and that's, you need to do it because these are the supports because you need those supports to be able to fulfill your role as a mother, because that's your right and you should be supported in every way possible to be the mother that you want to be, just like every other woman in the community. But then it's a very daunting position to be in. You have to sit there and highlight the things that you can't do. And then how dismissing is that of all the beautiful things that we can do? It takes away, you certainly don't feel like a good parent, I can tell you that, going in and having to explain why you need somebody to help you drive your children to school or make their dinner or make their beds, help get up in the morning routines and things. We need to be advocating towards the NDIS to be working with us in a much more empowerment model versus looking at the deficits that we have, rather than, it's meant to be capacity building, but we still have to constantly lean on all the things we can't do in order for the system to listen and to enact and to provide the services that we do need. And just the framing of that language going into those conversations, how that then starts to, sort of position other people around us in positions of power. So then they start looking to informal supports around somebody with a disability. And this is where you start getting in those power imbalances, and especially within, intimate partner relationships where there's children involved, who's seen as the competent parent. It's documented, for one. So if there is, the marriage breaks down, all of that stuff of what one parent can't do is documented, that then could technically, and I, in my own opinion, I 100% believe that technically that stuff can be harnessed and used against you in a family court. Now, this leaves us in really difficult positions, and again, this is where disabled people being in the driving seat of the NDIS, looking at this policy, how to phrase it, how to frame it so people feel that they can work with the policy rather than feel threatened by the policy, and how to view mothers as being having the right to be the best mother that they can with the right supports, versus having to constantly say, these are the things I can't do. And then how can that then be sort of harnessed and used and turned back on you? We've lived in, as we discussed earlier, all of those systems have been systems that have been used against us, that we do not trust. And all of a sudden we have to go in there every 12 months and beg for our livelihoods. Every 12 months we have to go in and remind them again of all the things that we can't do and why the system needs to support us. It's a very, very disempowering model. It is one that is full of anxiety. The reframing of that language, having trusted conversations with these people, is something that is not happening yet. And the other thing is that, when it comes to these conversations, and you might see some stuff going around about independent assessments for disabled people moving forward with the NDIS, we need allies jumping up and down with us. We need allies stomping their feet, you know, telling the government that this is wrong, you know, advocating with us, elevating our voices and helping us, because we need that right now. You know, the NDIS is meant to give us our choice and control, but ultimately, you know, all the people around us, the systems, the policies, the planners, everybody has power in these relationships except for us, and we're still on the back foot and we're exhausted. You know, NDIS planning meetings, all of those conversations with those people are fraught with difficulties and anxiety, and if anything, moving forward, this is creating more trauma for our community as well.
One of the questions that we have from an audience member, Emily, who says that she's new in this space, and wanted your views on whether our systems need to be completely overhauled or dismantled. Can we advocate to make the current system work for us? An example would be thinking about the quality of ongoing cultural and disability awareness training.
Absolutely. I think it's hard to work out whether they need to be overhauled or dismantled. I mean, in the 20 years that I've been working in this space, there has been change. I've got to say that. And some of that change is positive. Some of that change has been negative. So it's not all bad. There has been a recognition that the professional training in all of the spaces is absolutely required. And, you know, training in police is absolutely required. But the thing that we've got to remember is that when you're a new police recruit, to get some cross-cultural awareness training for a few hours, you know, an afternoon of a six-week program, for example, is barely adequate, especially if you're going to then get sent out to a remote community. You need much more than that. And I would argue that it's not cultural awareness training you need, it's cultural safety training you need. It's engagement and training that's delivered that reflects on what it is that, from an Indigenous person's perspective, about what you need to be safe in your practice, right? Thinking it through their lens. If you've just got someone coming in saying, well, here's the history, here's the policies that were enacted across Aboriginal people, you need to be mindful of the Racial Discrimination Act, you need to be mindful of these things, that's not going to cut it if you don't understand what it's like to live in those communities and to know what it's like, what the history, the local conditions and local history has been around police relations, right? So I think that, you know, we do need to reflect on what has our training been, right? And how do we improve the training such that it's not this one-off token training, but rather something that's meaningful, that embeds us as part of the process, so that it's an ongoing dialogue that we're a partner in, not something that's not meaningful, not productive.
Mm.
For me, I'd like to burn the system down and rebuild it from the bottom up. I would love to see a shifting of the way that we write policy, do it like we do with design work, you know, iterative, you know, and working with communities so that it suits the community in which you're writing it for, and not just say, you know, the disability community as a whole of Australia, but going to smaller pockets. So what the disability community needs in Victoria might be different to what is needed in WA or in rural settings, and working from that bottom up versus top down perspective. What is the community needs and wants, and what is the community that we're looking to build structures for, and working that way. And all right, then what does, you know, and then what would that building look like for that community versus let's build the building and then let's see how the community fits inside it. That's for me what I would like to see done. And I know, and I've sort of stumbled on this more recently, sort of, you know, all our gender equality, you know, debates, is that our gender equality isn't very intersectional at this point in time. It is still very, you know, white, straight, able, neurotypical, cisgendered, and it's not reflective of the community that it sits within. But even sort of then going on further from that, the more I look into the disability of the community, the less I see gender equality being spoken of or implemented. or even gender equality policy amongst our, you know, disability orgs. And I've seen some pretty interesting behaviour happen throughout this year that's really made my eyes open in that, you know, gender equality hasn't quite made its way to the disability sector. You know, I guess I'd had the luxury of sitting with, you know, orgs like Women with Disabilities Victoria or being involved with WIDA, Women with Disabilities Australia, and then realising that there's all these other orgs that sit outside of them, and how we need to push and expand them to be more inclusive of the community it's meant to be representing. But I definitely think that, you know, sort of, you know, taking it all down and then building it back up. And if we're having people going out into communities, why aren't we looking to, you know, train up, skill up and employ people from our own communities to work with and for people from our own communities? You know, what better way to have cultural or, you know, competency around language of ableism or language around disability than having disability people working for the NDIS as planners, you know, disability people with disabilities working, you know, within child protections or working within the police force and, you know, looking to employ a much broader subset of the community to work for right policy for the people that they, you know, sit alongside and represent as well.
Yeah, I think you're right, Nick, because I think in many ways the intersectionality is missing in some of our sectors. We have it in policy, but we actually don't have it in practice. And yes, when we think about the individuals that sit in those intersectional spaces, their experiences are of being turned away from services because services can't engage with their intersectionality. And so we do have to open that space up better.
Yeah. And what a better way to build trust amongst, you know, sort of, you know, people in the community and the services that they need to engage with than to having, you know, people from those services that are actually people from their own community. I mean, that's all, you're already one up on the conversation. There's already an element of understanding there before you even get into, you know, what you're there to do as well.
Yeah.
I'm just mindful that you're both, and I myself and probably many people watching today, feel like they're laboring on multiple fronts. And it's certainly been a big year with a lot happening on other fronts that are disproportionately impacting particular groups of women more profoundly than others. Obviously, the pandemic, among others. How do we maintain? I've been thinking a lot about kind of hope and resilience. And this question was put to me by the Feminist Writers Festival about how do you avoid burnout? But I think I'd probably like to expand that and a little bit. And how do you not only avoid burnout, but maintain hope?
That's a good question. And what I will say is that in all of the work that I've done, both personally and professionally, my hope is in the community. So whenever I get frustrated talking to ministers or to government or to services, sitting around a table or sitting on the grass with our community is the motivator, because they ground you in what is reality. They ground you in what are the solutions. They ground you in their resilience and their hopes for the future. And they motivate you to continue their fight, because it's not your fight personally, it's our fight together to create safer worlds. It's also sitting, I've been a foster carer of Aboriginal kids, and to also sit with our kids and to realise that they're our next generation, and knowing that we have to do better, a hell of a lot better, to ensure that their futures are safe, is also a very strong motivator, because, you know, those little beings are just the most precious things in this world. And, you know, sitting with them and thinking about how we teach them that violence isn't okay, teaching them that they can be ambitious, that they can have hope for their future, that they can be anything they want to be, that they're not going to be conditioned by a world that thinks less of them. It is something that we all should be committed to. And that certainly does give me hope and commitment to this work.
Yeah. Yep, all of that, absolutely. This year has been a tough year, Chris. You know, you did touch on the fact that we've had the Let Us Speak campaign happening down here in Victoria, and that's been, I've been sort of behind the scenes with Nina with that since about April or May, when it first became apparent that the law had changed and, you know, my own right to be identified as a sexual assault survivor had been essentially taken away and stripped back. You know, being able to sort of have the energy to keep doing that, relying on a lot of allies around me in conversations, and this is actually reflected in, and we've had the independent assessments issue come up. We've had lots of things happen this year that have been quite confronting, and it has been hard and difficult and quite draining. I have my moments where I just need to disconnect and cry for a day, and just, you know, feel very out of touch and not great. But I know the next day I sort of cycle back into, all right, let's get stuff done again. And what was reflected via Nina, and also reflected via Sam Connor as well, is that while I have breath in my body and I've left no stone unturned, I will keep doing this until, you know, that the rights for our people, and until, you know, even if we're not successful, I can't stop doing this, you know, no matter what. And I won't stop until I've exhausted every avenue possible that I have within me. And if that means burning out, well, then I'll burn out, I'll recoup, I'll come back, and we'll fight again another day. But just knowing, and that's, you know, I can't live with myself at the end of the day. If I haven't put everything I can into that, then I find that more difficult to deal with than burnout. And it was good to hear that reflected from Nina, and it's also been really good to hear that reflected from Sam Connor as well, that, you know, while she has any energy left in her body, she is going to keep fighting those independent assessments, and so are, you know, the rest of us as well, to, you know, uphold the rights of the people and our, you know, the women and all disabled people. And with the gag laws, you know, whether or not we got that amendment in that bill in Parliament just this week, I watched 9 hours of parliamentary debate, but it was sort of, well, we left no stone unturned. We didn't stop fighting. And if that's how it is, that's how it is. Well, we regroup and we come back and we see what it is that we need to do next. And, you know, sometimes it is very tiring. Can we just stop having to fight them? Can they just get it right for once? But until that happens, you know, relying on each other, communicating with each other and collaborating is massively the key. We can't do this as individuals. We can't do this alone. Yeah. And that's that collectivism within multiple communities and within the disability community, which is what is going to sustain us and keep us going.
Thanks, Nick. I always go back to that quote from Rebecca Solnit, and anyone who knows me has heard me quote this a million times, that hope isn't a lottery ticket that you sit around clutching, feeling lucky. It's an axe that you use to break down doors in an emergency. And I think what I see amongst you both and so many other individuals working in the sector is that they do view hope as a daily active practice, and you are breaking down, using your axes in a myriad of different ways to break down those doors, because we are in the midst of an emergency. And I just honor and respect the myriad of ways that you do that, and the way, your capacity to maintain that hope, because I think maintaining that hope is central to tackling the culture of violence that we've been talking about today, and the framing and you know, all those issues that we've been discussing today. Thank you both. It's been a really wonderful, enlightening, eye-opening, moving discussion here today.
We hope you enjoyed the conversation. Our thanks to the speakers and chair, our podcast partner, Listen Up Podcasting, Creative Victoria, the Beeson Family Foundation, and Queen Vic Women's Centre for vital funding support. For more FWF goodness, visit our website, feministwritersfestival.com, and find us on socials.